Devices Radio Network.
If you've enjoyed Scott Stevenson's contribution to Muscle Minds, you can learn more about him, his products, and his services at his website, fortitudetraining.net. Those who purchase Scott's book or any of his coaching products receive a free subscription to his message board where he answers questions daily. So check out fortitudetraining.net. Muscle Minds is made possible in part by Jordan Peters. If you've enjoyed listening to Jordan today, check out his website, trainedbyjp.com. The site offers over 50 hours of video content covering everything from the most basic approach to training and nutrition for beginners, all the way through advanced anabolic and insulin strategies for seasoned competitors. You can follow Jordan and Corin's blog as they prep for their next shows and have questions answered daily on their forum section. So check out trainedbyjp.com. The views and opinions of Muscle Minds is for entertainment and educational purposes only.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Better than he was before. Better. Stronger. Faster.
To Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson, Jordan Peters, and Scott McNally, part of the Advices Radio Network, a new voice in bodybuilding podcasting, presented by Max Gear.
Welcome back to Muscle Minds, episode number 3. I'm lucky enough to be here with two very muscular minds, Jordan Peters and Dr. Scott Stevenson. Scott, how you doing, man?
Nice intro. Way to wing that, Scott. I like it.
Thank you.
I'm good. I'll forewarn my littlest dog, the one I've mentioned previously, had knee surgery, is on a tear today. She was just literally 5 seconds ago outside in the yard just running in circles because she now has clearance to be off leash, and she was playing with my other dog, so I think she may have calmed down, but if you hear growling in the background, I'm not running a dog fighting ring or anything like that. She's just going bonkers and she's having fun.
No kidding.
So things are good. I'm glad to see that with her, especially. Always makes me happy when she's happy, because she did not like the limited activities.
Yeah, it's been a while too, hasn't it? It's been like a couple months.
It was 8 weeks with limited leash only, and then I think it's been like 3 weeks now since she's been allowed to be off leash, which, nice. Yeah, it's, she's very happy about that.
I've been noticing you've been putting a bunch of videos up lately. Every week or so, I see something new.
Yeah, those are just, that first one on the clean eating, which we talked about before, just was a thought that, like, I should just post something on this, just if it, you know, maybe clicks a switch in somebody's mind. And the other ones, people like those. I'm like, there's all sorts of little things I can just, without much preparation, because those are basic exercise physiology, muscle physiology, bits and pieces that I can share. And I enjoy doing those, because I just like, this feels like a good time to do it. It's a nice day. I go outside with my dry erase.
Yeah.
And start working on it. Funny, even just last night, the last video, for those who haven't seen it, these are just on my Facebook page, and they're actually on YouTube as well, on the Fortitude Training playlist on my YouTube page. But the last one was on fiber types, and it's just the some of the historical background about how we've how fiber types can be determined based on muscle physiology and histochemical staining techniques and those sorts of things. And those terms are used synonymously when actually they're not. And literally last night I just saw someone just sort of kind of bastardize the idea of fiber types in response on a thread. I saw one on a bodybuilding board. Okay. And it's interesting, because the thing that I see so often is people take the notion of fiber types, and it's sort of like a little bit of a trump card in that I know more than you do. So they just say, this depends on fiber types. And it's like, okay. And they use the term fast twitch, in this case. You get a lot of fast switch fiber types. Well, in human beings, we really, you're not measuring twitch, twitch speed. Except in certain circumstances, you can when using electrical stimulation, but that's an old fiber type classification that's sort of been considered to be synonymous with what would be a type 2 if you stain histochemically. And so just kind of threw that out as like, yeah, you don't know. This is how it really all comes down to fiber type. And then he used fast twitch in the context of human fiber. It's like, you're missing the piece here that really isn't how fiber types are determined. So I've even thought about just collect, because I see that always, like literally, not always, that's an over-exaggeration. I see that very frequently. So I thought about just collecting like bits and pieces of quotes where people just sort of throw fiber type out there in a way that really doesn't make sense. So anyway, I'm glad I did that video, because hopefully it's one that will be referenced that's really an oversimplification. And I could go into that, but the thing is that when you train, literally your fiber type changes depending on how you're measuring it. Twitch speed will change. Fatigability will change. The myosin heavy chains will change. And the idea that we're classifying by specific fiber types, 1, 2A, 2X, or what have you, that's really just a way to sort of bean count the fiber types that doesn't necessarily match with the physiology. And I give some examples in that video. So, yeah, those are fun. Those are cool. So people seem to like.
They're kind of cool too, because it's not a huge commitment for the viewer either. You can just, you know, go to your page, or like you said, to the Fortitude YouTube page, and just click on that, and you know, I'll have 5-10 minutes, and boom, I can throw something in there, and it's always something that I wouldn't have thought about. So it's cool, man. I appreciate those. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. That's what it's for, man.
Jordan, what's happening with you, man? How you doing?
I'm not too bad, thank you. Just tucking into a bowl of cereal.
Nice. So you just got back from training, right?
Yep. Another good session in the books. Training's going pretty well right now. Body's happy. Taking some all-time PBs on stuff, and yeah, pretty excited to just keep rolling with this right now and seeing kind of where it takes me.
Nice. You hit a personal best today, didn't you?
Yeah. So today was a push. It's not really a push session. It's kind of like a push plus bits session. But incline barbell press was my first exercise. And yeah, 190 kgs for 6 reps. So I was pleased with that.
What does that come to ballpark pounds-wise? 190 kilograms. What is that, Scott?
Like 415 or something like that. Wow. 425 maybe. 425, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Man. did you happen to catch it on a video for your site?
It's on Instagram. I've already put it up.
Oh, nice. I got to go check that out. Awesome. All right, guys. Well, we got a bunch of questions here over at the Advices Radio forum. If you go to forum.advicesradio.com, there's a section called Q&A for Muscle Minds under the bodybuilding section. And this first one is about something called Abana. And it's not something I'm familiar with, but I know that both of you guys are. The question is, Dr. Scott, are you still a believer in Abana? If so, could you cover some of the benefits that you feel it adds to diet and wellness? And is it now called heart care, or is that something different?
It's the same thing. So the Himalaya Wellness, or Himalaya Herbal, is the name of the company. It's based in India, and they have a number of formulations they've come up with based on Ayurvedic medicine. It's somewhat confusing because they've got several websites. I think if you go to HimalayaHerbal.com, HimalayaWellness.com is the one that I prefer to go to, because that's where you see the research papers that they have supporting their products. Some of the pages, they talk about medicinals or pharmaceuticals, and then supplements. They have skincare stuff. They have internal medicine, the pills that you can take, herbal formulations. So they've sort of tried to market themselves in various ways with these different websites. And you'll even see, you know, when you do a Google search, the different sites come up. And they don't always have all the same information. They started doing this years ago, and I'm like, where's all their research stuff gone to? It kind of frustrated me because I couldn't find it on the site I'd normally gone to. But Abana is the same thing as HeartCare. They just used a different name for the supplement so that it gets across better for, I think, Western English speakers. So HeartCare is it's a blend of herbs that they've got several studies backing up as a way to improve lipid profile.
Hmm.
It actually elevates HDL and reduces LDL.
Nice.
It also has a blood pressure lowering effect as well. So you can read through their studies. There's probably 15 or 20 over there at HimalayaWellness.com. I think you click on the research tab, and then you'll have to go to Abana. So that's half of the thing. If I had one criticism for them, I would say, you know, include the both names when you're looking for things, because you'll go into that research section and they don't necessarily call it HeartCare. They call it Abana.
I see.
Which you have to realize is the same thing as HeartCare. And so some of the studies are cohort studies without a control. So they take individuals with hyperlipidemia and they give them Abana, and then they see these effects. Sometimes they'll have case studies as well, but in whole, if you look at some of the literature that's there, assuming that they aren't, you know, selectively not publishing or making available studies that don't show a positive benefit, seems like it works well. And I've had some clients who use the products. Usually, though, I have to admit, if someone tells me they've got, you know, a lipid profile that's kind of way off, of course, I send them to their doctor and make sure they, you know, use that resource. But we're going to do other things too. You know, we'll increase their fish oil consumption, and they may use, you know, we may have added niacin in. There could be a number of things that'll go on. So I can't say that, you know, every time I just keep everything the same and we just trust in HeartCare to create improvement in lipid profile, but seems to work from what I've seen. So,
okay.
Yeah, it's a nice product.
Is this something that you take, Jordan?
I have done. Right now, I don't. Simply because with these healthcare supplements, you could just keep adding and adding and adding.
Yeah.
And there has to be a limit as where it's like, okay, I'm just going to stop taking everything under the sun that has some kind of research to suggest that it'd be beneficial. So right now that one's not on my list that I'm using, just because I'm spending on curcumin, Super K, citrus bergamot, krill oil, that will all be having an impact on my lipid profile. So I can't see on top of those spending out more for Abana to bring a benefit.
Okay.
I have used it, and yeah, like Scott said, it looks pretty good. So just have a read around of the research that's available on those other supplements that I just mentioned as well, and see what kind of impact they potentially will have on your lipid profile.
Do you think that krill oil is that much more beneficial than regular fish oil is?
I read some literature to loosely suggest that it will have a benefit on your lipid profile, superior to that of fish oils. But that being said, it depends on where your fish oils are being sourced from and the quality of those. And then it comes down to a cost factor. Krill's quite expensive.
Yeah.
So to get the amounts you would need from krill probably isn't a cost-efficient way.
I see.
I use a little bit of krill on top of my fish oils.
Mm, okay. That makes sense. So, Scott, after that, the same guy asks about the difference between ubiquinol and ubiquinone. And he asks if the ubiquinol is that much better. And then the same question for curcumin versus the super bio curcumin.
I want to bring up a good point Jordan made, is that eventually you can end up with sort of a plateau effect. You know, you start taking everything, and if you look at the mechanisms underlying, or at least if they're whatever they may be known underlying, the different supplements you're taking, you're just like, you know, you're hammering the same mechanism from multiple angles, and you can only hit the nail on the head with so many hammers when one will probably do. So there's no need to have, you know, four hammers or two hammers in your hand when you can get the same job done with one. So the heart care is just nice because it's several things all rolled into one. I even went over to the site, and they've got, like, the first study that pops up is basically showing that there was an equivalent effect of the heart care to simvastatin. And this was published in 2002. So it has effects similar to those of you find with statins. I have to go and look and see if one of the ingredients is an HMG-CoA reductase, which is how statins work. So there's some issues with those. But ubiquinone and ubiquinol are basically the same molecule. Ubiquinone is the oxidized version, and ubiquinol is reduced. And they'll interconvert in the body, essentially, and be used as an antioxidant wherever it's sort of needed. So it, I can't say that one is better than the other, because your body, once you take in one form, it'll convert it to the other one. And it'll basically function sort of as a wild card antioxidant in that sense, where there's high free radical stress, it will function as an antioxidant. And then an inner conversion can happen elsewhere, where free radical stress, or in the same cell, of course, where free radical stress goes down. So it's there kind of as a free radical buffer, you might say.
Hmm.
So I wouldn't pay an extra, twice as much for one particular form. So the other question was about curcumin. Yeah, the BCM95 is the best choice still, as far as I know. I wrote an article, it's a few years old now, for John Meadow's site on that. There's some new formulations coming out, like the Mariva, which is a phytosome formulation, and those that one seems to work well, and the data suggests that it's bioavailable, which is sort of the main issue with curcumin. I've got a friend who has a lot of joint pain, so she uses the curcumin as basically as an analgesic or an anti-inflammatory, and so she switched to the Mariva. And it works really well for her. She'd been using the BCM95 for a while, but she was having to take, and she's about 110 pounds, and she was having to take, I think, three or four of those pills to get much of an effect. When she did, it worked great, of the BCM95. So now she's switched to the Mariva, and it seems to work pretty well for her. So there's curcumin, which I think is what he's asking about, just sort of the generic curcumin supplements. There's a super bio curcumin, which is the BCM95, and super bio curcumin is what Life Extension Foundation calls the BCM95. You can get that same patented form through other sources. Other people sell it with their own brand names. I think the prices are pretty much always the same. I've never heard of anyone thinking they got bunk BCM95. I think the people who make that probably are pretty careful with who they distribute it to. And then there's an advanced biocurcumin that LEF, Life Extension Foundation, sells that has some ginsenosides, which are the active ingredients in ginger, and those can have additional benefits as well. So via antioxidant actions. So just so people know, because it gets kind of confusing. It's like there's a super biocurcumin, and there's advanced biocurcumin, and there's just curcumin. It's getting pretty pretty tough to sort it all out. So But anyway, the BCM 95 is really still, as far as I know, the one to kind of shoot for. That's the one to look for, okay, and get that, you know, where okay, you can. Yeah.
I tell people that they should get a notepad and their favorite pen out when they're listening to this show. And that's the reason why right there.
Yeah. Well, it's confused me too. Cause I'm like, oh yeah, they have the advanced one and the super one. What's, you know, which one's the combination with Ginger and which one's okay. Now I remember. So yeah, it does get confusing.
All right. Next question is about, post-contest, looks like he says, theoretically here, if you had a new client who came to you after having done many shows close together and had quickly rebounded badly, how would you proceed from here? Do they need to maintain higher calories for a time period to let their metabolism recover? And if yes, how long? Is there any things to integrate for enhanced athletes to help with this process? What do you guys think? Either of you are welcome to jump in here. And it sounds like, I mean, I think that the answer is going to be, no matter what, it's going to vary probably, because I think you just kind of, you play with it and then you watch the response, right? And it's kind of like building a fire. You don't know how much you're going to put in. You just keep building the fire until you build it, right?
Yeah. Jordan, you want to go? Since I was on the last one.
Yeah. It always frustrates me when I hear people rebounding badly after a show. Like, I don't really know what rebounding badly means. Binged, that's what it means. And it annoys me every time I hear it. Because it's just don't do that. Just don't binge, for a start. And you're going to be in a really good spot by just having some self-control for just a few more weeks. And just slowly introduce food. But obviously that's not the answer they're looking for right now. These situations are pretty hard to fix quickly, because if you put back on 30 pounds in the space of 3 weeks, in my opinion, you screwed your whole off season. That's it. Your next off season is done. So the best thing you can do really is look to get some of that weight back off. And it should come back off okay if you can work really, really hard and you can drop back down to some low calories again for a bit and try to reestablish where your body weight is at in terms of where your calories are at, where your body fat's then at a suitable level to start to grow again. Because obviously the further you get away from your stage weight, every bit of weight that goes on thereafter is just more inclined to be fat. So you can't just keep pushing your calories up in the hope to then make any progress. So this is why I try to say it all the time. If you binge, you have ruined your whole chance of making progress for your next competition. But yeah, I can't stress that enough, how important it is just to not do that. I personally would try to get some of the weight back off, to be in a good spot to ready to grow again. That would always be my goal.
Yeah, I'm on the same page. Rebounded badly is a nice way of saying is that you just kind of went on a multiple week binger. Unless there's various reasons why this could happen. You just went hog wild, and probably preceding that during the diet. This is very often someone who, quote unquote, suffered badly. They were doing lots of cardio. They may have had to resort to pretty high levels of fat burners, maybe thyroid medication, the whole kit and caboodle. And they're like, I just can't wait to get done with this. And you see this, people posted on Facebook. I've seen it so many times. And I cringe when I see someone who is in that last week before the show and their main focus is on what they're going to eat afterwards.
Yeah.
Cause I'm like, that's a rough, you know, that's a rough mindset to have, because then that's what happens. They go hog wild. So, so the reasons this could happen could be someone just goes crazy with the food. They could have just decided they drop all of their pre-contest supplementation or a large amount of it right off the bat. And, you know, that can cause an estrogen rebound. That can cause a lack of the thermogenesis from whatever, or lack of fat oxidation from their supplements. So you put all that together, and it's like you're supporting the house of being that lean under various pillars of the diet, the exercise, maybe the cardio, and the supplements. And all of a sudden you get done and you just basically pull all three legs out from underneath and boom, you come crashing down. So my thought is as long as this is healthy, I mean, you don't want to, you know, if you stress yourself out and you know this medically speaking, this obviously doesn't make sense. So common sense should apply, but go back to some semblance as best you can and of your contest or your pre-contest diet and regimen. And then stay there until you get down to a reasonable starting point for an off season, just like Jordan was saying. And then slowly transition from your post-contest period into an off season. So this would be, you know, taking out your typical pre-contest supplements one at a time, or taper them off as the case may be, kind of depends on which one, or reducing their use, their frequency of use, until eventually, you know, you've moved yourself out of that place. An important thing that I like to do, we've talked about this before, just in general, I think it makes sense because of my perspective on people are training really hard and using peri-workout recovery supplementation, is that in this spot, when you've just gotten done and you've been eating chicken and rice, you know, this sort of super boring, tasteless diet for a while, in this sort of generic scenario where someone's really rebounded, is that person, they need some psychological relief, and they just sort of like just collapse, you know, after the show, and they rebound, if this is the case for this person. So in order to sort of provide something to look forward to, having large meals after the workout is the best time to do that. So, you know, if you use the peri-workout, you know, recovery supplement, if that's what you're doing, but, you know, make this a time to restore your normal social interaction with people. Say, hey, you know, shift your workouts even if you too, so you can go and meet friends and have a big meal and enjoy yourself. And, you know, to the point where you're feeling full but not absolutely bloated, like you have to like roll out of your seat to stand up. And that will give people some relief just in and of itself, as well as if you're working out still, if you're training and it makes sense for you to train, you don't have, you know, injuries that are prohibiting that. You're only going to go a day or two before you get to have a bigger meal. So there's a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel of when you're still on this restricted contest diet. So you're easing yourself back into normalcy, whatever that means for a bodybuilder, if there is such a thing. That's another podcast I know you're doing, Scott.
Yeah.
You're easing yourself back out of one form of orthorexia into another form. And so this gives you something to sort of look forward to. And also dieting yourself back down, you can drop, a lot of times it's just water. 30 pounds in 3 weeks, for example, like Jordan had mentioned, you know, a lot of that's water. So you drop that water, you start looking better. That reinforces your desire to go to the gym because it's fun to train. You're still getting great pumps. You feel better because you've got some more food in you. And training can be fun again. So making the training enjoyable, maybe even switching programs, even if it's not the best thing to do for making gains, but you need to do it because you need something new and different and fun. You know, pick a program like Fortitude Training, for instance.
Fortitudetraining.net.
Fortitudetraining.net. And have, you know, do something that's fun and enjoyable for you. So you're in there and making this, the endeavor, something that will persist because you're reinforcing it with, you know, positive experiences by having fun training and, you know, getting to eat good meals, regular food to a certain degree. And slowly transition from that rebound back into a, you know, a reasonable off season regimen.
I like that. I wasn't expecting you to take it that direction. I thought that you were going to just talk scientifically about how many carbs you should start with and then what you should do with those carbs and what you should do with the protein and stuff. I like that approach, though, and it makes a lot of sense to me, too. It definitely is. It's a crazy time. I feel like if you don't have an eating disorder before you get into bodybuilding, by the time you're done with a contest, you probably do.
Yeah, well, there's DSM, you know, criteria matching eating disorders, and then there's disordered eating, which, you know, most bodybuilders may, you know, they fall along a spectrum.
Yeah,
I mean the nature of the endeavor is one that entails what some people might say is disordered eating. So, like for this particular, I mean, if someone says, you know, they love the post-contest, they love looking how they look, they're not having rebound, then you can like go into, you know, what's going to be the best strategy for inching forward, gaining as much muscle, as little fat as possible. But in someone who's rebounded like this, I think underneath that, this is just sort of my experience, my armchair psychologist perspective, is that they're rebounded because they're sick and tired of having to count every gram and follow this program. They need to get out. They're like, you know, they finally like gotten themselves out of the pit of the pre-contest period, which they might not have liked. And now they're just going hog wild on the other end of the spectrum where there's absolutely nothing there.
Yeah.
So sliding back down to something, you know, that gives them that relief is more important than, it's just not going to work. It's like, you tell them, you know, you should do this, this, and this, and this. Like, no, that's the root of the problem, is having to eat in a very specific discipline, quote unquote, discipline manner. That's why they have the issue. So you're just adding oil to the fire.
Yeah.
To the fire if you tell them to eat in that way, I think, because they're just going to reject it.
You know how I read this question, and I think it was different than both of you guys had. I was picturing more like, I know a lot of bikini girls that will do this, where he has said that this particular person had done multiple shows back to back to back. And I see girls that do that, especially girls. And there's a lot of the guys that are smaller, like the men's physique guys, that don't have to peak as hard for a show. There'll be a show every week for the next, you know, 2 months almost, or every other week. And they just do them all one after the next. And then they get out of that and they've burned their body out so much that then their metabolism is just crashed. You know, they've got the quote unquote metabolic damage. And that's where I thought he was going with this, was how do you fix metabolic damage?
Well, the evidence for metabolic damage isn't particularly strong.
Okay. I do think, though, and I know that term gets overused a lot, but I do think, though, that you can kind of dig yourself in a hole.
Yeah. And that's a good angle, because my take on that then is really a variation of how I just answered it. And that's to look at where your caloric expenditure comes from. And a lot of it is going to be from non-exercise activity thermogenesis, the things you're doing, you know, throughout the course of the day.
Fair enough.
So get back to doing fun stuff. It's like you take, you know, hikes with your wife like every weekend, right?
We tried to, at least when it was warm.
Right, yeah, not so much anymore. Yeah, you're not one to climb Mount Everest because it's, you know, -30.
Right.
But finding, you know, fun things to do, even if it's just like, you know, go for a walk around the mall, you know, or someplace where there's, you know, HVAC, and start doing fun things that you enjoy that involve activity, you know, because that's going to replenish your neurotransmitters more than likely, because you're doing something that's fun instead of trying to restore some sense of happiness with food. You know, like this is, and I'm absolutely no expert here, but you know, it makes perfect sense that if you've denied yourself food and really you see it as such, you see it as suffering, and something you would rather not have to do. You're not really into, for instance, the science of what the ideal way would be for you to diet down and manipulating your diet. That in and of itself isn't intrinsically valuable for you.
Yeah.
Maybe you have a coach. This can be an issue with coaching, which is a whole other can of worms. is that you've got individuals who are being kind of told what to do. They wish they didn't have to go through the diet.
Mm.
It'd be interesting to do a poll if you just said, if you could just like not quote unquote suffer and feel uncomfortable and hungry, and just sort of magically week by week drop the body fat, would you do that? And without having to have any understanding of what's going on, I would imagine a lot of people would.
Hmm.
So they're resisting the very process because the process in and of itself is not intrinsically interesting to them. So it's not cool to see, oh man, when I did this, this is what happened.
Yeah.
I really think this is neat. You know, they're not a tinkerer per se, like Jordan obviously is, like I am, like you are. You like you want to see how things work. So it's kind of like someone who, you know, they've got a car they're going to bring to a car show. And every week they have to, every night they have to go in their garage and tinker with the car, but they hate working on cars. They hate grinding a wrench. They hate painting stuff. It's like, I just got to do this. And then when they're done, they just close up the garage to the car and they just let it sit in there. They don't maintain it. It gets dirty and nasty and what have you. So it makes sense that when you've dieted down and you really don't enjoy the dieting and the pre-contest process, that you're going to like try to throw that away as much as you can,
yeah.
And use food to which you've been denying yourself, or at least that's how you see it, as a way to sort of, you know, restore yourself to normalcy. Whereas there are other ways to do that. You know, you can find, you've got other interests, you've got other things that you like to do. You know, ideally those to be things that keep you active,
yeah.
That will offset some of the increased food intake. So you sort of balance things out. And in your life, so that you're not so single-minded in just reversing the lack of food with as much food, reverse the lack of food with other ways that you can find to enjoy your life. And that's, of course, depends on the person and what they find to be fun, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we could go so much further into that. I do think it's like, it's a society thing, I believe. I mean, I know that like my mom thinks of food as entertainment. And it's the way that I was raised. It's the way that I think it's like you go out on a date. What do? You go out to eat. You know, what do we do? We get together with our families and, you know, we have Thanksgiving dinner. It's all these things are it's all around food, you know. It's mm-hmm. So I do think it's ingrained in us. And I feel like what you're saying makes a lot of sense. It's for a lot of people that aren't familiar with the quote unquote bodybuilding lifestyle. It takes some adjusting to realize that. And I remember that feeling. There's like a feeling of emptiness at first before you get that, because you're no longer like filling that hole. You know what I mean? You have to be comfortable with that. Comfortable with not like filling a void.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in the easiest place, this is where I'm really lucky in this sense, is that I don't have that sense of comfort food. And sort of in place of that, I really enjoy you know, being the tinkerer, changing my diet, testing different things out, supplements, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if you have a strong connection with food, and of course, you're right, this is a huge can of worms, but a lot of times people who do have comfort food as a particular sort of a centerpiece of their psychological happiness are often people who can end up being larger.
Yeah, absolutely.
Overweight. So then what, of course, especially with today's, you know, social media and what we see in advertisements, et cetera, the pressure to lose weight and to be leaner and to fit that body image can be even greater. So you've got a, you know, a recipe for rebound and disaster, and especially if you're thinking maybe of bikini competitors, because I think women have even more pressure than men do in this regard.
Sure.
You've got someone who's a comfort food centric, so to speak, who then ends up being a little bit overweight. So then they diet themselves down and they have to remove all that comfort food. When they finally get to that spot, they've really suffered a hole. Their hole is deeper than the average person. And they're, you know, and sort of the cognitive dissonance that they have too, when they see their body fat going back up. But they need that comfort food at the same time. Can create, it's actually called an abstinence violation effect.
Mm.
And this is what happens, for instance, to health behavior thing, like with smokers or drinkers, alcoholics. When someone has violated their abstinence from a particular substance, so let's say it's a smoker, and they've abstained from smoking, and they haven't smoked, and then they get into a situation and probably most people listening to this have either done this or they've seen it with a friend, where they smoke.
Yeah.
Then they just say, what the hell?
Yeah.
One of my professors used to call it the what the hell effect. And they just say, what the hell? And they just start smoking. And they just, they fall right off the wagon and they just go for it. So you can get that, I think, in someone post-contest where they violate their abstinence.
Sure.
From all these foods, and then it just triggers the abstinence violation effect, and boom, next thing you know, they're up 30 pounds in 3 weeks or more. I don't know if I ever told the story about the worst rebound I ever heard of, where a guy gained 60 pounds in 5 days.
Holy cow. Was he hospitalized?
Yeah, eventually he had to go in. They had to hospitalize him. He was, this is a friend of a buddy I went to grad school with who was, he had won the Mr. Ohio. And he was extraordinarily, I guess you could say, OCD. Like, he ate nothing but tuna. He's a really big dude. Just, he was just all out in everything he did. Apparently, I think he was on the cover of one of the big magazines,
okay.
Flex or Muscle and Fitness. This is back in the day. And he was a heavyweight when this is maybe before they had the super heavy category in the NPC. And he won, destroyed everyone in the show, and got done with the show. And he hadn't eaten anything but tuna, like, for, like, months.
Yeah.
So you can imagine. And just, like, the guy used to do, like, 225-pound skull crushers for, like, sets of 15 to 20. He was, like, just absolute beast. So they got done, and they went out to eat, you know, and he ate a gigantic meal, you know, just everything he could squeeze down. And then he got up in the middle of the night and ate again, and they were driving home, you know, and they stopped off to get gas, and he went to the convenience store and just went up and down the aisles getting all the chips and, you know, crazy stuff. And he ate like that. And when they got him home, I guess he was holding so much water already. He just had to lie down in the bathtub
because
he was scared he was going to shit himself, you know, and it just like, he just like couldn't move. Like, he's like, at least I'll be in the bathtub, you know, cause I can't really get up to move around. And after 5 days, he had gained 60 pounds and he had pitting edema like everywhere, like up in his arm. Like, you could literally bury your finger in his deltoid. There was so much fluid retention. It would leave a hole.
Wow.
You know? Yeah. So there's a situation where this person had denied himself so much, and he also was quite an extremist. You know, there's probably some body image issues there where, you know, he's like, man, I'm so small, I'm so teensy, even though, you know, he's ridiculously huge and, you know, very low body fat. But he still probably felt small, like a lot of pre-contest bodybuilders do, because they're lighter. And in clothing, you look smaller than you do without a shirt on. So... anyway, yeah, I think there's a really complex issue here. So I think just trying to, like, force someone to go back to something that's really highly regimented, that doesn't have really addressed the underlying issues with food that may have precipitated the binge and the rebound is just a recipe for destruction, because you're not really going down to what the root. Of course, it depends on the person, but what the root might be. In terms of what's going on psychologically with them.
Yeah.
That caused them to do this.
Yeah. So, that makes total sense. Yeah. We had a question about joint pain, but I'm going to skip it to get to something a little bit more exciting, and then we'll come back to the joint pain question. It's a steroid question. He talks about, he's asking about the binding affinity of steroids. And he's trying to figure out, he sounds like he might be a newer guy, because he's trying to figure out, like, what's more binding and what's less binding. He actually wanted to kind of see a list of order. And the reason that he's asking is he's trying to figure out, when putting a stack together, you know, he's wondering if there's going to be redundancy, because, say, Tren and Test are going to have a much stronger affinity than something like Masteron. He wonders if that means that the Masteron is then going to be redundant. And I understand, you know, a few different things here that I could explain about it, but I'd much rather hear what you guys think. Do you want to take this one, Jordan, to start?
Yeah, sure. So the idea of the rate at which steroids will bind to the androgen receptor is based upon methyltrienolone, which they scale it from, which binds the strongest to the androgen receptor of all anabolics. The order at which, off the top of my head, they bind is methyltrienolone, trenbolone, nandrolone, primobolan, testosterone, masteron, equipoise. I may have got that wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's right. And then orals will elicit their benefits through non-androgen receptor mediated mechanisms, which aren't really fully understood. And we just know that you can use multiple orals and they won't necessarily conflict with each other in the manner in which they'll bring about benefits. So I liked this idea and the way it sounded. Okay, that makes a lot of sense, that when you're very lean, you would then only really want Masteron, as an example, to elicit its benefits, therefore dropping out your trenbolone and bumping up your Masteron would then possibly make you harder and drier than trenbolone offsetting Masteron's ability to do its job. That sounds good. That being said, every single Olympia competitor is using trenbolone and Masteron together.
Yeah.
Every single good bodybuilder I have ever spoken to is using trenbolone and Masteron together. When I dropped out my trenbolone and I bumped up my Masteron, I got flat. Will I ever do that again? Because the science suggests that trenbolone binding to the AR might offset my ability to utilize Masteron. The answer is no. I'm going to use my tren and my mast together because I tried it. I thought about it logically based on what everyone else is doing.
Yeah.
And I disregarded that idea. So that's my standpoint on it. So I fully understand the question, and I liked the idea as well. It sounded sexy to me. I was like, oh, wow. I might rather get really fucking dry because my trend's stopping me from doing that. But to me, no, keep your trend in and just get really damn lean, and those drugs will do what you expect them to do.
That's my take. Nice. What do you think, Scott?
That's a great answer.
Yeah.
You know, that's really a great, it's a great answer. The other thing too, aside from, and I haven't seen this, I've looked, I mean, aside from the relative ranking of binding to the androgen receptor, I haven't seen, because it really isn't quite understood that well. You could look at the androgenic to anabolic ratios, but those ratios really don't tell you about an absolute effect. And what I'm getting at here is, if you have something, let's say it's tren, binding to the androgen receptor really tightly, and that doesn't necessarily say that the non-androgen receptor mediated actions, the non-genomic actions of tren are minimal. It's not one or the other. We do know that a lot of the orals don't bind very tightly, like Anadrol has very minimal binding to the androgen receptor. So that would tell you that its non-receptor mediated activity is what's accounting for its anabolic actions. But because an injectable typically binds tightly to the androgen receptor, doesn't mean that it has no non-androgen receptor mediated actions. So that you could probably, if you went in and dug out each of the individual studies, you know, where they measure muscle growth versus prostate enlargement to give you an estimate of anabolic and androgenic actions of a given, in a rat, of course, in a given steroid, you could look at find the absolute values, and maybe do a comparison that way of the anabolic versus the androgenic actions. But that still doesn't tell you about, explicitly tell you about antigen or non-antigen receptor mediated activity, because you can get anabolic activity from antigen receptor binding as well as non-antigen receptor binding. So you've got kind of different angles to look at this. You can look at the binding to the antigen receptor You can look at actions that are non-androgen receptor mediated. They say non-genomic because of the basically the dogma of how binding to the androgen receptor elicits protein synthesis, transcription, translation, and protein synthesis via binding at the genome, at the androgen response elements. So that's one way to look at it. Then you've got androgenic versus anabolic. And there's also the complicating aspect of metabolites as well. So someone goes back and plays the order that Jordan gave in terms of androgen receptor binding, you'll see that nandrolone is higher than testosterone. But nandrolone, when it's converted by the 5-alpha reductase enzyme, because dihydronandrolone is one simple way to refer to it, that has lower androgen receptor binding, lower androgenic activity than testosterone. So the relative rates of conversion also make a difference. And then you have to consider, too, that we've got multiple pathways for metabolism of different compounds. So
yes,
androgens can be aromatized, they can be reduced, and of course, then the liver is taking care of them as well. So if you're, for instance, blocking aromatization, then you're preventing efflux through that route, and you might have more activity at the 5-alpha reductase enzyme, for instance, on nandrolone. So when you start adding those things up, you've got a pretty complex chemical soup going on, that only one piece of which is the androgen receptor binding. So then it kind of comes down to what works, which is exactly what Jordan was saying. What do people find actually works? And can you take one aspect of this and say it's going to tell you everything? No. It's kind of like saying, looking at, you're going to size up the value of a house, and you just look at the quality of the HVAC. It's like, oh, it's got a brand new air conditioning unit, you know, and it's got a great heater, and the ducts look brand new. Well, you know, that doesn't tell you about the roof. That doesn't tell you whether the house has termites, whether it's got a pool, or the size of the yard, or what have you. Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of bits and pieces that will tell you as to how the whole thing is going to function in the chemical soup that an individual might be might have going on in their body in terms of ancillaries as well as super supplementation.
Those are kick-ass answers to that. I like this stuff.
Yeah,
you guys cool. had mentioned tren and keeping it high. I agree. One thing I have wondered, Dave Kalik talks about how tren, with higher progesterone in your body, that it can be harder for some guys to lose lower back fat. That's been his theory. Have you guys seen this in the real world ever? I feel like there was one year that I had the tren in pretty high, higher than I normally would. And I don't know whether I just didn't diet long enough, but that year I didn't get as lean as I would have liked to have. I felt like I still had a film in my lower back, and maybe I could have pushed harder, but it was the only time too that I did keep the tren in higher. He tends to lower it down for that reason. Is this ringing a bell for you guys in any way?
Like, I think Scott will better answer this better than me, because I go back to the same kind of skeptical approach in these scenarios, that trenbolone is a really effective drug for causing decomposition.
Yeah.
And that I can't personally see that
being okay.
the reason that you haven't got things all the way in. But then I may just not be well read enough on that area, so Scott will probably better give a better answer than me.
I've not seen that, but okay. That's not something that, you know, pops out. One thing to consider, you know, just to go back to the question that triggered that thought in your mind, Scott, is that, you know, tren's got progestogenic action, and it's got androgenic actions. And trenbolone does promote lipolysis. So, and there's also the possibility of estrogenic actions being mixed in there as well as a reason for holding body fat. But tren tends to promote body fat loss in most folks. So It's a balance of, you know, to what extent would progestogenic actions be impacting lipolysis versus to what extent the androgenic actions impacting lipolysis. So most, I mean, there's a reason, I don't know if you've heard this before, but some people have said trenbolone is like poor man's growth hormone for that reason, because it helps with body fat loss so much. So no, I'm trying to think if I've even heard anyone just say that or post that on a board. It's not something that,
I've never heard it.
Yeah, I haven't either.
Yeah, I've only heard it from Dave
Kelly. That's why I said, that's why I said maybe I'm not well read in it, because I just never even heard that before.
Okay. Yeah, I had only heard it from Dave Kalik. He had talked about it on a few different podcasts. And then, you know, last week when I had Boston on, he had worked with Dave Kalik, and he said that, that Dave had pulled his trend out pretty low in the last couple of weeks. But, you know, it's something that he obviously believes in. I'd like to talk to him further. I should see if I can get a hold of him. It'd be interesting to kind of find out more of what his reasoning is, because he's obviously a bright guy, you know, so...
Well, you brought up a thought to my head, actually.
What's that?
Connection with what I just said. Well, what is pretty low for trend?
Oh, that's a good question.
In the Boston Lloyd context. because yeah, there's a dose response, too.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, if you think about, if just think about this androgen receptor binding, and you think about, you know, normal eugonadal testosterone production. You know, 7-10 milligrams per day, something like that. You know, 100 milligrams being a what was probably for many people going to be a testosterone replacement dose. And then you talk about someone who's using 500 or 600 milligrams of trend, per week, let's say. So they drop that in half to a low dose of 300, which is what, you know, some people might consider a low dose. So who knows what the dose response is when you're, and before I forget also, you've got, so let's say it's 300 milligrams of tren, and then you multiply that by the relative binding affinity of tren versus testosterone, and you've got a really high binding of tren to those androgen receptors. But I don't know what's going on in terms of any progestogenic effects, what the dose response there is, especially in guys. So... yeah, maybe. I mean, maybe there's something going on with someone who's on a gram of tren.
Yeah.
You know, which people do. There's also the possibility that if you're taking into lots of tren and it's making you feel really crappy and you can't sleep at night and you've got night sweats, then your body is just like, okay, I'm not very happy here. I'm going to hold on to this fat as best I possibly can.
Yeah.
Cortisol levels might be really high. Whether those would outcompete all that androgen receptor binding, I don't know. Or androgen binding to the cortisol receptor as well, I don't know. But I could see a situation, this does happen, where people are using so much stuff that they are just like, they're basically toxed out.
Yeah.
I think Jordan mentioned this before. It's like when you feel really, really crappy, that's telling you that something's off. You're not going to make good progress whichever direction you're going in. You should, there's some amount of discomfort, of course, but when you're just like, you know, you just feel like you're toxed out, like you're hungover.
Yeah.
You know, removing something that's causing that toxicity can be a very positive way of moving forward, whether you're trying to gain size or drop body fat. Reducing that, you know, excess stress.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Then I could see that for sure. And with that reduced stress, boom, your lower back gets tighter easily. You know.
Yeah, that happens a lot. So that makes sense.
All right, back to joint pain. It says, what are Scott and Jordan's Peter's advice on dealing with both acute and chronic cases of joint pain, given that diet, fish oils, and things like that are already on point? Jordan, you want to start with this one?
Sure. I mean, trying to pinpoint what's causing the joint pain initially is paramount.
Yeah.
So avoiding loading usually is what's going to allow this to heal. So it's a possibility that this individual is only working in one kind of rep range and is not aren't rotating their exercises. And they're very much, let's say, as a scenario, using like a Dorian-esque approach, that style of training, hammer your joints. So if you're looking to train things frequently, then vary your rep ranges. Or if you are training things still just once a week, make sure that in the sessions you do, you're giving your joints some respite by training things across a multitude of rep ranges. That, I feel, really helps a lot for me. When my elbows start to get beat up, for things like tricep isolation moves, I'll stop the loading. Because I'll try to facilitate hypertrophy from increasing metabolic stress, but by sparing my elbows in those, it allows me to focus on my loading and my compound moves. So really at no stage am I compromising hypertrophy across the whole, because I'm still able to load. Because if I try to load on my tricep isolation moves, that buggers me from being out of press, then I'm going to actually compromise hypertrophy. So try to think of smarter ways to program. Leg extensions, again, could be a key one here. That will be the exact same thing. I was on a run where I was really going after my leg extensions, but I just absolutely destroyed my knees doing it. I've never had knee problems before, ever. Despite all the heavy loading, I've never had knee problems. But just the leg extension caused those kind of issues to me, which was then knocking on to my ability to load in my compound moves. So obviously now leg extensions fall third or fourth exercise in the session, and they won't be anything under 15 reps. So all I'm looking really to do from the leg extension is flood my quads with blood before I stretch them. So to me, addressing the issue in that kind of way is going to see you fixed across the long run. And then, like what Scott mentioned earlier, you come in, fish oils, trying to manage your inflammation as best you can is also going to help you quite a bit.
What do you think on this one, Scott?
You said acute versus chronic cases of joint pain, so that kind of piqued the interest of my clinician mind. Well, acute, I mean, normally an acute joint pain is suggested that you've got an injury, like literally that some structure has been damaged. Not that you've got sort of chronic overuse syndrome, or you've got chronic pain that's been going on for a while. So you want to make sure you haven't actually injured yourself. So check that out with somebody. So that's absolutely super important. What Jordan said too, is there working around the injury or finding exercises that don't cause pain can be the hardest thing for people to do. Especially when they have a marriage to a particular exercise. I can't count the number of guys who squatted for years and years and years, and now they can't squat anymore. Because they just thought squats, it just kills their knees. And some of those people, I think, make great gains with squats, but a lot of cases, I look at those folks, and they're still training, but they've got joint pain now that is limiting them from training their legs just in general. And I still squat, and I use my top squat so I don't destroy my shoulders. And people like, how old are you? You still squat? I'm like, 46. Yeah, I'm still able to do it. And I'm not saying that anyone who can't squat is, you know, made a grave error by this age, but I'm able to do that because if I start, you know, having joint pain, then I just don't do the exercise. And I just find something else and, you know, train like a maniac with those other exercises that work for me. The other thing, too, that comes up a lot is when people say joint pain, they're not necessarily discriminating between pain in a joint, arthralgia, and pain that's due to tendonitis in a tendon, because they just like someone might have a tennis elbow, a lateral epicondylitis.
Yeah.
which is pain at the junction of the tendon to that bony landmark, the epicondyle, on the outside of your quote-unquote elbow joint. But it's not actually in the elbow joint. It's basically a tendonitis that's come about. So understanding what it is that's going on, if like literally it's in the joint, then you've probably got a cartilage issue and it's going on chronically, and like you're going to have to do something about that. Like, as Jordan said, you know, chondrolation patella or patellofemoral syndrome from doing knee extensions is really common. That just used by, I couldn't do those for like 10 years and now I'm able to do them. But only if I'm very careful not to do them when they're starting to cause some issues. That's just how my knees are. My mom has terrible patellofemoral syndrome. So I think I, you know, picked that up from her to a certain degree. So working around it is absolutely paramount. An ounce of prevention is a pound of cure, as they say.
Sure.
And I had a client who just did this, with some issues, and he what happened with him in part was that he, and this is an important way to kind of look at this, is he likes to enjoy the holidays. And he still trained when he was starting to have some issues, but you know, he was, you know, having some drinks and eating some of the cookies, et cetera, et cetera. So he switched to a more pro-inflammatory diet. And he kept on training, didn't avoid things. And next thing, now he's going to have to take a break from a lot of exercises probably, and work around something that crept up on him just in a matter of like probably 10 days.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't proactive with it. So now it could send him back weeks and weeks and weeks. So figure out whether it's a joint injury, whether it's actually a joint, whether it's the tendon, work around it. Finding someone who can do some deep tissue work potentially, or do some kind of massage. So an ART practitioner or a Twainau practitioner. Stretching can be really, really important too, I think. I'm fairly certain this has sort of saved me, and I get this sense, I think I've talked about this before, is that if I don't go in and stretch out, I feel like I would probably injure myself on the very first warm-up set if I hadn't stretched beforehand. So stretching is absolutely vital. I mean, it doesn't take much stretching to ensure that you maintain a decent range of motion. And there actually will be there's some interesting data with immobilization, for instance, in animals. There's one study in mice where they immobilized the limb, and they wanted to see how much stretching actually was necessary to keep the immobilized muscle from shortening its length. So if you immobilize a muscle at a shortened length, it'll remodel itself so that all the contractile proteins set up their resting length to match the length of that shortened muscle. So we take that muscle out of the cast and try to move it through what was initially a normal range of motion. It's no longer a normal range of motion. You take it to the end of the joint extension, and that muscle that's now shortened is way out of its normal plateau for producing force. It's way off kilter. So they could, just doing like a half an hour of stretching a day was able to prevent that. So 23 and a half hours of being casted and a half an hour of passive range of motion exercise was able to prevent that shortening of the muscle. So I think this probably applies to muscles that you regularly on the course of your day to day don't take into those extremes of range of motion that we see when people are training. So, I mean, how many times do most people, unless they stretch, get their pecs into that lengthened, elongated position that you're in at the bottom of most pressing movements, or at if you're doing like a wide, deep fly? Probably not at all, except when you're training. So there's some protective effect there. The research doesn't suggest this, but this is really my kind of personal opinion after having, you know, been doing this for like 35 years. Is that I think stretching is absolutely paramount. If you're sitting at a desk and you're not doing something that affords you normal or really extended ranges of motion during the course of your day, which is true for most folks. So I think that helps with tendons as well, just stretching them. So figure out if it's a joint injury, if it's really acute or chronic, whether it's in the tendon, stretch, and then all those things that, you know, Jordan, we've mentioned before about dealing with joint pain, the cissus and cosamin, curcumin, etc.
You know what? I'm going to jump ahead here just a second, and there's a question that I feel like it could be a good follow-up for Jordan here. And then I have just one more question for the end of the day. But our follow-up question here is specifically to Jordan, and he said, would you mind sharing your protocol for curing your tendinitis with BPC-157? And he asked for what your dosing was, what the duration of weeks was, and did you change anything with your training at the time?
Yeah, sure. So I typically always have that stuff in the fridge. Just because I'm popping fibers all the time. I have a few other bits as well that Scott has advised me in the past to always have to hand. The Dajiao is a good one. And there's a homeopathic cream that I can't remember off the top of my head.
Tramiel.
Yeah, Tramiel, that's the one. Yep. So I always have those, just because they're really, really effective, to be honest. So that, and TB, BPC-157. I used, I believe, off the top of my head, 200 mcgs as close to the site as possible.
Yeah.
Causing irritation twice a day, every day for maybe 7 to 10 days. And when things are really, really, really shitty. And then to aid it in the session itself, Kuanglun oil, which you can get from eBay or Amazon, the same as the Dit Dajiao and the Tramiel. And then some single ply elbow sleeves. Make sure they're thin, don't use thick sleeves, in my opinion. It's better just to have it really, really warm through some thin sleeves as opposed to really relying on the sleeves.
Yeah.
I'm not keen on that. Double and triple ply sleeves, I hate. Just something nice and thin that you can then ensure keeps everything nice and warm. In terms of exercises, just like I previously said, change your manner in which you're loading. And then if you have to do feeder sets, so then you ease yourself into a weight that at no stage then causes any tendinitis irritation, or a tendon irritation rather, is going to be favorable. So by that I mean, let's say you're doing, again, a tricep pushdown. For me, tricep isolation work is my biggest cause of tendinitis. If I do if I do skull crushers and I'll go straight into heavy work because I'm strong at those, that's it. Tendinitis immediately. I got rid of my tendon issues and I was feeling really good. And in one of my sessions, I was strong and I did dead stop skull crushers, which I'm strong at. And I was doing 90 kilos for like 10 reps, which is like 200 pound skull crushers. And immediately that caused me just instant tendinitis. It was back with like a vengeance, how hard that came back. And I had no irritation for weeks prior to that. Just that one exercise literally just pissed it off so much. So if you have exercises that you know have the ability to do that, just don't do them. Like I'm just never doing that exercise ever again. And then if you are still trying to do like some cable push downs and whatnot, and let's say for example you would normally use like number 10 on the weight stack for 12 reps would see you fail, start off at number 7 and do 10 reps. You shouldn't really hand, or maybe even number 6, so it's nice and light, so then you don't have any pain. Then do number 7 for 10 reps, number 8 for 10 reps, number 9, and then you'll probably fail on that around 10 reps. So you wouldn't usually be able to hit the same kind of max load that you would if you hadn't done those feeder sets, but you're then not doing that exercise for loading. By that point, you should have wrapped up your loading work. And then, like I said earlier, you're just trying to facilitate some kind of metabolic stress through that exercise. So you could keep your rest periods fairly short.
if you're still having issues at that kind of loading, then I would move to occlusion work, where you're then dropping the loading down by like 50% again. And that's going to really allow you to cause a lot of metabolic stress with minimal tendon irritation that should then hopefully give it a respite to allow you to keep your pressing going. Because remember, it's the heavy compound pressing that's just king in everything that we're doing here that's going to facilitate growth. So the rest of it's just kind of like the icing on the cake, really. That's how I've always seen it. So if you have to occlude, I don't think that's a bad thing. I did that for 3 or 4 months, and I lost no upper arm size. I've mentioned this before, but the only size that I lost was forearm size, which came back instantly once I was able to load a little bit more again.
I bet.
So that's kind of my advice with that.
All right, I've got one more here, and once again, I'm jumping forward a little bit, but this one, it just tugged at my heartstrings, so I wanted to get it in the show, and I thought it would be a great way to end the day here. He says, first of all, I'm a big fan of you guys. I just turned 18, and I'm in my final year of high school. I'm confused as to the choice of what to do with my life right now. When I think about what would make me happy in the future, it's people like Dr. Scott, Jordan, John Meadows, and Shelby that inspire me. I want to become a successful coach one day, and I would immensely appreciate it if you guys would give me some direction on which academic and non-academic path that would be best to pursue, in your opinion, right now.
Scott.
And he also adds, Scott, he said, this answer could change my life, so no pressure.
I know.
But seriously.
I have a question here in front of me. I was reading that too. So, yeah, this is, it's nice. Well, first of all, feel blessed that you've actually sort of figured out something you're passionate about as early on in life as you are. Because some people never figure it out. They never, I mean, and for what it's worth, you know, I think Scott McNally would fit in this list of names because he's doing the same thing. You know, I think you are, Scott. We talked about it.
Well, thank you. I'm just trying to follow and do things like you guys are. You guys inspire me too.
You're just you're doing what you love, and that's kind of really what it comes down to.
Yeah.
You know, I read a quote, and I can't remember who said it, but it was something along the lines of, a good life is one where someone's work and their play cannot be distinguished, essentially.
Hell yeah.
So that what you're doing is it's all kind of all the same. I used to, when I lived back in Tucson, I think I went like three times to, I think it was a sixth grade class. A buddy of mine from the gym was a elementary school teacher. And, he had me come talk to his kids about passion and also about discipline. And the way we kind of start that off is, people would say, oh man, you must be so disciplined. You go to the gym like, you know, X number of times, and I can just tell it takes a lot of discipline. That would just be the, you know, the comment. And I'm like, no, this is just, I'm doing this because I want to. This is what's enjoyable to me. This is my passion. And if you can find that, you know, I think there's another quote that maybe is overused and trite, but you'll never work a day in your life because you're doing what you love. So yeah. I think he knows this already. You know, he's kind of figured this out. At least for right now, and it's okay to change in the future too. It's not that's not the worst thing. It's just to kind of follow your passion wherever it may lead you. But so the question is, which directions, academic or non, would be the best to pursue right now? And I say both, because you're going to learn some from the way of knowing through academia. And you're going to learn a lot by being in the trenches and figuring stuff out. And then you can start connecting those things. I think there's a pretty cool synergy that goes on, because the light bulbs that you'll get in the classroom will be matched by the light bulbs that you get in the trenches in the gym. So get in, make yourself your own, the best bodybuilder you possibly can. I mean, I mentioned where I sort of would sacrifice what I know, or what I strongly suspect is going to be the best for my bodybuilding progress individually, because I'm using myself as a guinea pig to try things out. And that way I kind of know where I learned just from becoming my own, you know, evil scientist, using myself as the case study. So do that and then, you know, start coaching people. And you're going to learn a ton from that. You may not like it. That's the thing. You may not enjoy coaching people as much as it, as you know, fun and glamorous as it may be. And then I'm not sure what the exact academic paths are in Italy, but I've decided to, you know, become an exercise physiologist. When I started, I went into a generalized program because I wanted to become the world's greatest personal trainer. This is before there were such things as online coaches. And I went to a generalized program, so I took classes in health behavior and sport management. For instance, that the notion of abstinence violation effect is one I picked up in a health behavior class in 1994. And it still stuck with me. So I started there, and then I realized that what I really loved was teaching. And in order to be able to teach at a higher level in university, I need to get a PhD. So I went on to study with a guy named Gary Dudley, who's since passed on, who's a brilliant mind, genius level guy. And I think I've told Jordan some of the funny stories about him. And I just kept on learning and, you know, loving it, pretty much every step along the way. So, the other thing is, don't be afraid to change your path or to challenge people along the way, with what you happen to know from some other way. If you run into someone, you know, for instance, in academia, which, and this can be the case, get so many examples of this. Then if they're good at what they do, if they're good scientists, then the whole point of science is to challenge ideas. It's not to, you know, put a death grip on some particular theory and then do everything in your power to not let go of it. The idea is to challenge it and test it and pick it apart and see where the holes are, so you can fill those in with better information. Hmm. And I'll finish with a kind of a story that just fits with that. When I was, I just started at University of Georgia, was working on my PhD, and I'd been there like maybe a month, and Dr. Dudley comes into the lab. We started talking about something, and I don't remember what it was, the topic at all. But I, you know, we sort of got into a, you know, a pretty heated discussion. And I was just sort of, you know, challenging him, and he was challenging me. And of course, you know, by the time he left, you know, he wasn't like we shook hands and smiled and went our separate ways. He kind of just said, okay, whatever. And he left. He walked out the lab, and I'm like, another lab mate was in there, fellow doctoral student. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I just fucked myself, didn't I? And she's like, no, you don't know him. He loves that. No one challenges him like that. He loves that. That would just made his day. Do that every single day. And I just needed to know his personality to know that he loves that kind of stuff. That's what he lives for. So doing that and learning how to do that is going to be something that's going to keep your mind fresh. And if someone bucks you, then, you know, that's probably just their ego not wanting to be wrong. And of course, we all have a little bit of that. But don't be scared to change your direction and follow your bliss and do what makes sense. And that may mean just dumping the whole university, as well. If you get into a program that doesn't suit you, find another one. I had to go I started one program in Colorado. It was horrible. It's terrible. I actually got laughed at by one instructor for asking questions. He was chastising me. Because I was asking questions that I know now the answers to, which he should have known as well, knowing what I know now. And I ended up going to University of Texas to do my master's degree because that program was bad. So I bounced around finding my way, but it was all worth it. So just keep following your passion and you'll get where you want to go.
Nice. Yeah, it's an exciting point in time, isn't it, for him?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's just starting. I mean, yeah. He's going to, I have to go look and see who this is. I'd be interested to see where he is in 5 years.
Yeah, no kidding. So what do you got going on for the rest of the day, Jordan?
I have some work to do. I have an essay due on Friday again. I'll probably get to Thursday and then annoy Scott because I'm a bit confused. not that he like helped me, but he pointed me in the right direction. So I want to make that clear because he's actually very unbiased when it comes to help, which is a good thing as well. But just to, when I'm stuck, he's been very kind to point me in the right direction a couple of times.
Nice.
Hopefully I won't have to do that this week.
I'm living vicariously, you know, wishing I were a student again.
How about you, Scott? What do you have going on? You're getting ready to train, aren't you, after we get done? Yeah,
leg day, baby. Big, heavy loading lower body for me. So
nice, nice.
I'm kick ass.
I've had this upper respiratory thing for about 3 days, so I'm going to attempt to train after we're done with this. I'm going to eat some food, and I'm going to head up, too. So, hey, Jordan, we had talked about having Corin on. Would she be available for our next episode?
Yep, that's no problem.
Okay, well then, guys, let's make this official. I will put a thread out, and I'll post some stuff on Facebook, too, directing people to that thread. Let's get some questions together for Corin. She's a freaking awesome bodybuilder, and we'd been wanting to get her on for a long time, and when we all first met, she was, in the depth of her contest prep, so... Now that she's probably not got a lot of time, she's got enough time that she could spend some time with us. That'll be cool, man. I'll be excited then. So tell her thank you in advance, please.
Will do. No problem.
All right, guys. So listen to the commercials. You can check out fortitudetraining.net. Check out trainedbyjp.com. These guys are awesome. I'm really grateful. As I always say it, I'm super grateful to have you guys here. I'm always learning something, and I feel like this program is of great value to the bodybuilding community. So thank you both.
Welcome, man. Take your time.
Guys, for Dr. Scott Stevenson and Jordan Peters, I'm Scott McNally. This has been Muscle Minds. Ooh.
Voices Radio Network.